from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Iran's security forces have killed more than 200 people since mid-November in a massive crackdown against those protesting the government's fuel price hikes. Human rights groups are calling the regime's recent acts of violence unprecedented. At 9, we'll talk about the civil unrest in Iran. Then at 9:30, a new Rolling Stone article looks at the religious right's steadfast support of President Trump. We'll talk to writer Alex Morris about what's behind that support and about her own story growing up in a conservative Christian family. And that's all next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, Amnesty International reported that Iran's security forces have killed at least 208 protesters and wounded and detained thousands more since mid-November when widespread demonstrations broke out in response to the government's decision to raise gasoline prices by at least 50%. Other rights groups are calling the Islamic Republic's recent use of lethal force unprecedented. And we're going to talk in this opening segment of forum about the political, economic, and humanitarian situation in Iran, and also how the international community is responding. Joining us is Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President for the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His books include Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He's also former president of the National Iranian American Council. And we welcome you back to forum, Trita Parsi. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I guess the place to begin is asking you for an update. Amnesty International has been calling this a killing spree, and it's been described as the deadliest unrest since the Islamic Revolution 40 years ago. What do we know at this point after 208 at least have been, protesters have been at least counted for dead?
Well, unfortunately, there is still a tremendous amount of details that we don't know as a result of the government closing down the internet and essentially having radio silence for a couple of days. We do know how it started. We do know roughly where the most violent uprisings have been and where the government has been truly brutal in repressing the protesters. But when it comes to the exact details, there at times conflicting eyewitness accounts. All we do know, however, is that the raise in gas prices started riots, which the government then suppressed very brutally. And for the first time ever, they completely closed down the internet.
And we should mention that the outbreak of the worst violence, which you alluded to, is in that city, which is largely an ethnic Arab majority. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, there's a city in the Khuzestan region of Iran called Mashhad that is that has a sizable Arab ethnic minority. And there has been some specific violence, and there are accounts of the Revolutionary Guards killing roughly 40 to potentially up to 100 individuals who were protesting. Some of the protesters, according to eyewitness account, were also armed, and there may have actually been fire from both sides. But nevertheless, the degree of violence that has been taking place from the government side is completely different from what we saw, for instance, in 2017, because in December 2017, there were also riots, and the government reacted rather differently that time.
And this group of protesters in the southwest took control of the city for about 3 days and actually blocked the main road to the city and the petrochemical complex. But the Revolutionary Guard went in there and just massacred, didn't they?
Some eyewitness accounts say that that's how it transpired. We do know that the protesters were blocking the roads and that that petrochemical plant is a critical plant. There's also eyewitness accounts saying that, you know, the protesters were also armed. We don't know exactly, and part of the reason is because of the radio silence and the difficulty to be able to get information out. We do know, however, that a very large number of protesters were killed by the IRGC in that city.
It's very difficult getting information with the internet down, but we are also hearing all kinds of blame going back and forth. For example, we've heard blame Ali Khamenei, who's the Ayatollah, has been blaming the West, of course, but also we have the opposition leader from the elections that caused the Green Revolution, blaming the Ayatollah. And we also have blame going from the hardliners to Rouhani and the reformist regime, or what's seen as a more reformist regime.
Yeah, the hardliners last time around actually were the ones that sparked the protest, and they were hoping that it would become strong protest against the Rouhani government. Rather quickly, it escalated out of their control and became a protest against the government as a whole. This time around, we've seen that as well, in which the protesters are protesting the government, regardless of whether it's the Rouhani camp or whether it's the Khamenei camp. But the hardliners are still trying to channel this as if this is just displeasure and anger vis-a-vis the Rouhani government. And thus far, it seems like they have failed in being able to deprive themselves of any guilt in what has been transpiring there in Iran for the last couple of days.
Haven't many of the protesters, though, really come from the working class and the lower income group of young Iranians? Particularly, I mention this because that's the base of support for the post-revolutionary Iran, isn't it?
It is. This is also very similar to what we saw in 2017, yet very, very different from what we saw in 2009. The protests in 2009 were largely driven and orchestrated and organized by upper middle class and middle class people. It were mainly in the big cities. The protests in 2017, as well as these ones, tend to be on a smaller scale, but they tend to be by the lower elements of society, much poorer people who in many ways have traditionally been considered to be the base of the ruling elite in Iran and the current government. In that context, it's also quite interesting to see how the big cities have, to a large extent, been somewhat calm and not had the same time of protest. I've spoken to people who were in Tehran who really had no clue what was going on because the Iranian state TV was not showing it and they were not seeing anything in Tehran itself. But they knew, obviously, that things were going on, but they couldn't see it. And it's also an interesting divide in society in which I've seen a lot of folks that are from the poorer class have been very angry at the middle class that they are sitting this one out, that they're not participating and that they're not partaking in this expression of anger at the government for its corruption, for its mismanagement of the economy, as well as this very sudden rise in gas prices.
So this is not another Green Revolution?
The leaders of the Green Movement thus far have not been part of organizing anything. But you mentioned yourself earlier on that the presidential candidate of the Green Movement have spoken out. He has condemned the government's use of violence. He has blamed it on Khamenei, the supreme leader, who, of course, he has this very long feud with right now because he's been in house arrest since 2009. And he also said something that was quite striking. He said that he compared Khamenei to the Shah because right before the revolution, there was a very big massacre in Tehran by the Shah's security services. And he compared Khamenei to the Shah, saying that the current dictator is with religion, but is doing exactly the same thing as the previous dictator did, who was without religion.
Yeah, that was Mousavi, and I was quite struck by that comparison to the Shah. We're talking, if you just joined us, with Trita Parsi about the unrest and really the protests that have been going on, the killings that have been going on in Iran. And Trita Parsi is Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I want to bring a local voice into this. Shahab Alizadeh is with us, and he describes himself as an advocate where Iran is concerned and has been talking to people back in Iran, family members and others who he's in touch with. Although, first of all, let me welcome you, Shahab, to the program. Good to have you aboard.
Good morning, Michael. I'm a big fan, and thank you for the opportunity.
It's been difficult, though, to stay in contact, I know, but you have a network, and what you're hearing from your network is they don't want a coup. They want reform.
Absolutely. They're tired of the struggle in the past, I would say 750 years, but recent history, 40 years of suppression and whatever happened after the 1979 revolution. They want reform. They want better life. They want better future for them and for their kids, but no bloodshed and not the price that they have been paying for the past 40 years.
The argument that we hear, particularly from the hardliners, is that the sanctions that have been levied by the United States are really to blame here, that somehow the cost of gasoline is, well, there's certainly a link there because of the exports and so forth. But how much are you hearing blaming or anger at the United States? President Trump, for example, just put out a tweet saying we support the protests.
Well, sanctions do have impact on the general prices in general, but the gas prices have been subsidized forever, and they could have afforded doing it more so. It's not about U.S. and what they do. It's their tiredness about the situation, the lies, suppression, and the bad economics overall. And we have all kind of resources, and we can provide better lives for the people, but they deny that, and they spend the money on other agendas.
Well, they spend the money on Hezbollah and, as you say, other agendas like that. But could you say something about your personal response to losing contact with your family now and how worried you are about their future?
Well, absolutely. It's been a nightmare. Although through landlines and some direct connections, I kind of knew, but for about 48 hours or so, I was out. It was horrible knowing that your close family and hundreds of friends.
Yeah, we certainly sympathize. And what I'm going to do now is offer the phone lines to our listeners, because I know there are many of Iranian heritage and background that may want to ask questions or talk about their own experiences now with this unrest that's going on and the violence that's going on. And if you would like to join the program, you can do that now by giving us a call at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, for your involvement in the program and your participation, is 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have or comments to forum@kqed.org. One more question, Shahab, if I could. The message would be likely to get out to Americans who want to support Iranian people. What would you tell them?
I hear Mr. Pompeo and other officials, you know, saying that people believe in the power of voting in America. We can have an impact with our votes, hopefully in the next election. And almost everybody has told me from back home they're hoping we, the Americans here, can change things, not only in Iran, but in the rest of the world too, with how we do participate in our elections. And this is our power. This is our opportunity to have an impact in the people's lives all around the world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and hope that you can get back in contact with your family. That's Shahab Elizadeh, who is a local advocate whose family is in Iran. And again, you can give us a call now if you'd like to participate. Number to call, 866-733-6786. Here's a listener who writes, "The fact is that the severe economic blockade imposed by President Trump after his recklessness in canceling the nuclear deal with Iran has created extreme hardship on the people of Iran." How much do you see it that way, Trader Parsi?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the Iranian economy was growing as a result of the nuclear deal. And once Trump withdrew from the deal, breached it, and started punishing countries for abiding by it, we saw a nosedive by the Iranian economy. So to disconnect this from the sanctions is just empirically wrong. And if you listen carefully to what the Trump administration itself is saying, they're taking credit for what is happening in Iran right now and expressing satisfaction with it. So there's no doubt that this is connected to the sanctions, but it's not the only factor. Of course, the Iranian government's own repression and incompetence and mismanagement has actually made the sanctions pressure more effective, in the sense that if the Iranian economy wasn't as corrupt as it is right now, the sanctions would not be as effective either.
What about the geopolitical effect of, well, there's a great deal of resentment, to use a proper word, I think, by Iran's neighbors. The prime minister of Iraq, who is very disposed toward the present regime in Iran, is no longer in power. And certainly, although there's been talk about rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, there's real difficulties with Iran and the neighborhood that they're in.
Oh, there's a tremendous amount of difficulty in the region as a whole. It's not just Iran. If you take a look at the region, almost every country has some form of a conflict with other countries right now.
Yes.
You have the Saudis kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon, having a blockade on Qatar, invading and causing this massive famine and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. You have the Turks, who up until 10 years ago had a policy of being friends with everyone in the region, who now are have tensions with almost everyone of their neighbors. And the Iranians are no different. So you have an extremely chaotic situation in the region, and much of it, frankly, is rooted in the invasion of Iraq by the United States that really rocked the existing balance that existed before, and the United States failed to create a new balance in the region, and instead the region has essentially been orderless ever since.
Let me bring some callers aboard. Dave, you're first up. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'd just like to respond to what your guest talked about as far as the sanctions. I don't think they should really be downplayed. We know that since those sanctions have been in place, Iran's economy has really been devastated. And, given the fact that, yes, it is an authoritarian regime, it is extremely repressive. If we hadn't put those sanctions on Iran, if we had stayed in the nuclear deal, there was the possibility of really seeing some progress made along the lines of diplomacy. That was never tried by the Trump administration. And I'd like to get your guest response about that, because I really feel that with those sanctions in place, it really started a downhill slide that we're seeing the terrible violence that's taken place now.
Thank you for that question, Dave. And as I said earlier, Trita Parsi wrote a book called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Are we perhaps now in what we might call the failure of no diplomacy?
Well, no diplomacy almost always leads to failure. And the caller is absolutely right. We had a great opportunity to build on the nuclear deal and make sure that the other concerns that the United States has with Iran would be dealt with diplomatically. And everything the United States has done in the last 40 years, nothing has been successful except the multilateral diplomacy that the Obama administration pursued. The Trump administration actually had this table set for them. They could just have continued it. But because of some form of a personal vendetta that Trump had with Obama, he pulled out of the deal. And ever since, we have seen this nosediving of the Iranian economy. Part of the reason why people are very angry, it's not just because the situation is bad, but because they also expected the situation to be much, much better now and moving in a positive direction as a result of the nuclear deal being resolved.
But in all fairness, it was also Trump said it was a bad deal. He said the United States was paying more than it should, and it was a terrible deal. And there were many who agreed with him.
The United States did not pay a dime for that deal. So you can have a series of criticisms against the deal, but the United States did not pay anything out of its pocket for that deal. And if you compare,
well, assets were unfrozen, weren't they? I mean,
those were not the United States' assets. Those are Iranian assets that were frozen by the Obama administration as part of the sanctions that was imposed on Iran by Obama. Then as a result of getting a compromise, because that's what diplomacy ultimately has to lead to. It's not that the United States or any other country can just dictate the terms entirely on their own. There has to be a compromise. And part of the compromise was that as a result of the Iranians opening up the nuclear program for full transparency, limiting the nuclear program to levels that simply could not be used for nuclear weapons, in return, their own assets would be returned to them. So that was not American money.
Yeah, let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Ali. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask your guest if he thinks that as a result, as a consequence of all these protests that have been going on, does he see the regime realistically making a change? Let's say these sanctions keep going on and the United States does not back down. Does your guest think that the regime, in order to survive, are they likely to make any kind of change in their behavior in the region, maybe cut back on all the foreign intervention? And thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. Trita Parsi.
I fear that, unfortunately, the pattern we will see in Iran is likely going to be very similar to the pattern we have seen in other countries that are under extreme sanctions or complete embargoes. What we've seen in those cases is that in order for the government to retain its power, they actually tend to become much, much more brutal, much more repressive, and oftentimes more adventurous in their foreign policy. That is the very clear track record of embargoes. We have very few cases. In fact, we only have one case in which a country under embargo transitioned towards a democratic government, and that was the case of South Africa. In all of the other cases, the situation, frankly, became worse, and the government tended to become more and more repressive in order to be able to retain power.
Our guest is Trita Parsi, and our next caller is Hannah. Hannah, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for your program. So one comment I have is I feel like as Americans we can learn. I'm an American-Iranian, and I feel as Americans we can learn from Iran, a former president, and what happened with Ahmadinejad, who is a populist. Very similar threats to what we see now with President Trump. In fact, one of the main reasons for the people being so mad is the corruption that started during Ahmadinejad. And I think we see very similar things during our current president. And the other comment I have is basically a wish that in this new election, President Trump isn't elected again, because I'm afraid that the second term will lead to a war in Iran. I definitely see the rhetoric of war happening already, and that really is actually to the benefit of the current regime in Iran, because they really thrive under war and the whole enemy, you know, attacking us, and that will give them another reason to suppress people.
All right. Thank you for those comments, Hannah. Good to hear from you. And another listener writes, let me go to you on this, Trita Parsi. I have to wonder how much reform in Iran has been stunted because of the original American interference in the coup of the democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. What would things be like if that had not happened? I mean, we can only speculate, but this is all often brought up. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, we can truly only speculate, but it is a scenario that is a very sad chapter in Iran's history, and unfortunately the moment in which the United States kind of lost its innocence in Iran. The United States orchestrated a coup against the democratically elected prime minister of Iran at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh. It was a very nascent democracy at the time, but it was a functioning one in the sense that the people elected a parliament, the parliament elected a prime minister, and the prime minister had certain responsibilities and the Shah had certain responsibilities. But with the coup against Mossadegh, we also saw that the Shah became much more brutal in his reign, continued to govern the country for roughly 25 more years. And we saw that as a result of this, once there was a revolution, it tended to have strong anti-American sentiments, because for a lot of Iranians, the Shah had become the American Shah as a result of that coup. Now, having said this, I think it's also very important to keep in mind that not all of these different things are determined by outside intervention. But the history of the United States and Iran, unfortunately, is so closely intertwined that it's very difficult to completely separate them from each other.
Yeah, and it was certainly behind, in many respects, the takeover of our embassy. We have seconds left here. Trita, could you say something about international aid or humanitarian aid, what people can do?
Well, it's extremely difficult, and part of it is because of sanctions. In order to even be able to send medicine or food to Iran right now, you would end up either violating sanctions, or if you manage to get a license to be able to do some of those things, you still do not have any banks that are willing to transfer funds as a result of their fear of sanctions. So the sanctions have really, you know, strangled the country, and also then prevented help from the outside to the population to arrive.
We'll have to leave it there. Trita Parsi, so good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Another segment ahead. We're going to talk about the power of evangelicals. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.